You bother me with your questions. You have to tell no lies.
No lies. You're always asking what it's all about. So listen to my reply.
You say to me, I don't talk enough. But when I do,
I'm a fool. It's times like this I realise.
I've got to shoot through and leave you.
The things.
You say. Purple prose just gives you... classic.
The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Today we're going to look back at the 94-95 season. It's the 25th anniversary of Blackburn Rovers winning the Premier League. Barry, how are you?
I'm very well, Max, but slightly feeling my age because just before we pressed record, we were discussing 90s bands and EMF came up. And it turns out we both know the lyrics to Unbelievable. And I was very proud of the fact that I knew the name of a member of EMF.
And I was very impressed.
Yeah, and then it turned out I was wrong. I got his first name right. I thought it was Derry Welfram, but it was Derry something else. So, yeah, anyway.
Well, you almost know the name of one member of EMF.
If I have achieved nothing else in life, Max, I have almost learned the name of a member of EMF.
Do you want to hear some nice messages? Two nice messages for us, Barry.
Okay.
All right. Message number one is from a man called Glenn, who says, "Hi, Max. Just wanted to say thanks for keeping the Guardian Football Weekly podcast going. I'm originally from Dublin, now living in Michigan. I discovered the podcast during 2014 World Cup. I've listened ever since. I love all the anecdotes and personalities. I must admit that when you took over from Jimbo, I did think, oh, no, not that twat. But it turns out my early scepticism was wrong. I love Barry, as we all do, and especially him being Irish. Can you ask him, have the Irish broadcasters RTE ever approached him for work? I would have thought he was a shoo-in to replace Dunphy and Giles on their football panel."
No, they haven't, and I wouldn't be a shoo-in at all. I'd say my friend and our colleague Ken Early would probably be well ahead of me in the pecking order, along with many, many others.
Yeah, but how many members of EMF can Ken Early almost name?
Well, that's the question. We should ring him up and find out.
We should. Glenn carries on to say, "I do think Barry's wonderful voice is beginning to be wasted on silly songs. I think we could all do with a bit of inspiration. Could he do Heroes by David Bowie? I did help out The Guardian this week. I could only do $20, but it's what I can do, and I'm happy to support. To all who make up the podcast, I can't thank you enough. You've been something to look forward to and a little escape during these difficult times." One other nice message says, "Hey, please don't mention my name on air, but just to say, please keep doing your pod. I'm a doctor with the NHS and involved in low-level COVID-19 planning nationally. And so almost all my time is spent thinking about and planning for the virus. But when I'm listening to the pods, I can focus on something else, at least for a little while. So I'd love it if you could keep going with it. It would mean a lot to me personally. And to be honest, I don't even like football all that much. I just really like the pods. Many thanks."
Well, that's fair enough. And it's nice that we're being praised. Not that we ask for praise, of course.
No.
But for the manner in which we are selflessly saving lives by association.
Yes, absolutely right. Let's just remember quite how important you and I are, Barry.
I don't think anyone should ever forget or understate how important we are in the fight against this pernicious virus.
And listen, nobody needs money more than me and Barry. So if you want to donate, it's gu.com/footballweeklypod. And I should probably be serious for a second and say that money goes to serious journalism and proper important things.
And not straight into our pockets where it should go.
Absolutely right, Barry. Now, let's look ahead as well to a brand new football podcast from The Guardian, Forgotten Stories of Football, a new weekly pod series featuring the best stories from the history of football that you probably haven't heard, written by some of the world's leading sports journalists, many of whom you will know from the pod. They've made it all fancy with proper sound design and specially composed music and all the things that our pod doesn't have. It's a bit like the audio long reads. It draws upon popular written stories from an already much loved original Guardian series. Will be narrated by a range of voices, proper actors doing it. We'll put the first episodes in the Guardian Football Weekly stream and have a listen to this, and we'll be back in a sec.
Welcome to Forgotten Stories of Football, a new podcast series from The Guardian. Each episode features a great story from the history of football you've probably never heard before. From the captain of France who murdered for Hitler, to the Sheffield Wednesday top scorer who acted with Charlie Chaplin, to the story of how primetime TV inspired one of the sport's most shambolic appointments with manager idol. Listen out for The Guardian's Forgotten Stories of Football. Make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's bring in Michael Butler for this part. Michael, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine. Thanks, Matt. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Thank you. So 25 years ago today, Blackburn won the Premier League for the first and only time, their first league title since 1914, doing it on the final day of the season at Anfield, despite losing that game because Manchester United failed to win at West Ham. Michael, you're a Blackburn fan and you were 7 years old at the time. What are your memories? I mean, it's peak age, isn't it? In a way, a brilliant time for you to win the league, and in a way, a terrible time, because then you think that's what football is going to be for your whole life.
Yeah, it was amazing, really, because I thought that, you know, obviously in the years preceding that, we were winning most weeks, and then it was just like incredible. I remember I was in the front room with my dad. I've got no idea why we didn't go and watch it, but we were crouched around a radio. But that is honestly one of my most cherished memories from my childhood. Like, my dad, who's normally quite a reserved man, just going absolutely mental in the front room, really like cemented my love for football.
And I mean, what are your memories of that season? Because 6 to 7, you can sort of, I don't know, for me, I loved football, but I wasn't really sure why at that time.
If I'm honest, the actual memories that I have are sort of confused by the amount of times that I've gone back and rewatched and you know, re-listen to all the commentary and things. And I don't think that makes it any less real to me. I mean, I remember things like the Tim Flowers performance against Newcastle, and I remember obviously Anfield and things, but basically just Shearer scoring loads of goals. but I think, yeah, I mean, other than those ones of just like being the only kid in the playground wearing a Blackburn kit and being quite smug about it, it's quite confusing to me to try and figure out which is which.
And Shearer scoring loads of goals, which were get over it and just kick it as hard as he could.
I don't think like Henri and Bergkamp had arrived with the idea of passing the ball into the net hadn't really like reached these aisles. So it was brilliant. And that's basically what all the kids did at school. You just try and just welly it as hard as you could and hope that it flew into the top corner, which it nearly did.
I put out on Twitter, Michael, that we were going to talk about this game, and you know, a lot of Burnley fans are instantly like, you know, you bought the league, and I don't know how you feel about that, because the story of Blackburn from sort of 91 to 95 is quite an interesting one as well, isn't it?
I don't think, obviously it depends what side of the fence you sit on. They were a second division club in 1991, 92 and came up for the first year of the Premier League, and Jack Walker spent a lot of money. I think he put something like £14 million in to building that squad. But, you know, that wasn't that outrageous. You know, I think United's squad for that season cost £19 million, and you know, you had other teams like Liverpool were spending, they spent £7 million on John Scales and Phil Babb combined. So it was a lot of money, especially for a small club like, you know, a relatively small club like Blackburn, who were sort of rising fast. But it's not like they were doing a sort of Chelsea where they were just paying, you know, 2-3 times the amount. They were signing players that were, you know, the best of the rest from the Premier League and beyond. They weren't going out to like Europe's, you know, biggest clubs and poaching them. Also, it makes a big difference that Jack Walker was a man of the town. Obviously, I'm looking back through like rose-tinted glasses, but you know, I think it does make a difference that, you know, he was born in Blackburn. He's Blackburn through and through. And when he was crying on the final day, you know, you knew that those were genuine tears. So. You know, I'm always going to be biased, but I think Blackburn were just doing what everybody else were doing, and they just did it better than everyone else.
If you look at the squad that won the title, they had Alan Shearer and Chris Sutton were their two marquee signings, but they did go on to sell both of them on for a huge profit, so you could say it was a shrewd business buying them. And then if you look at the squad, they had one sort of fancy Dan proper foreigner in Henning Berg. And then you've Mark Atkins, Ian Pearce, David Batty, Jeff Kenna, Jason Wilcox, Stuart Ripley, Tim Sherwood, Kevin Gallagher, Graeme Lasso. You know, this isn't the Harlem Globetrotters or the LA Lakers or Real Madrid. They bought experienced professionals who worked hard, and they weren't particularly big names, apart from, as I say, Sutton and Shearer, both of whom were sold on for a big profit. Colin Hendry, of course, in there as well, the modern day Franz Beckenbauer in the heart of their defence. So while they did spend a lot of money, and Jack Walker, you know, he put a lot of money into the infrastructure of the club as well. He helped rebuild Ewood Park. He bought them a new training ground, or paid for a new training ground. I think Burnley fans are slightly wide of the mark when they get, you know, on their high horses and accuse them of going all Real Madrid or Barcelona on everyone's ass. The one thing I would say is it's kind of ironic that Jack Walker's success as a local working class lad done good and buying his club and steering them to a Premier League title. Started the era of the super owner in the Premier League, and means no one like him will ever be able to emulate what he did in his hometown.
It's interesting, Michael, you've spoken to quite a few of the players for an article that's in the paper on Thursday. You talk to Tim Flowers and Jason Wilcox both about sort of how terrible the training ground was when they arrived, and Jason Wilcox talking about how they trained near a cemetery.
Barry mentioned it, that they built this brand new complex, but that wasn't until sort of 93-94 season. So, you know, when Shearer signs and they're in the Premier League, they're training basically on Sunday league pitches out on the outskirts of Blackburn, in a place called Pleasington Cemetery. And there's dog mess on the ground. There's wonky lines. The pitches aren't manicured, and it's in the middle of this cemetery. And Kenny Dalglish is there having to sort of stop training as these hearses pull past, and all the heads are bowed, they're being respectful. This is a Premier League side. And, you know, they're having to go back, they're having to wash their own kit. This is why this era is like, well, certainly in my mind, like, it's just so like romantic, because it's what all basically Sunday League footballers have to do. They have to shovel the dog mess off the pitch. They have to, you know, put the nets up. You know, the players had to go back to Ewood Park and for something to eat, and you know, it's basically the equivalent of going around the pub for a bite after the match.
Dave says the fact that Stuart Ripley is now a solicitor and has a 27-year-old son who is now also a professional footballer makes me feel very old. And John says, where is David Batty? Did you find David Batty? Because he's a pretty elusive man, isn't he, Michael?
So I do an interview series called 90s Footballers, and David Batty has been my number one footballer. And I've spent hours and probably accumulatively days trying to track him down. And I finally, through about six different links, got hold of somebody that used to be his agent, and who just told me to, in the nicest possible way, get lost, because he just doesn't want to know. One thing that he said, he doesn't want to be interviewed. He doesn't want any media. He's got his life. He's. I think he still lives in the same house that he did that he bought with Leeds in 1990, and even for like, I think Leeds had their centenary year last year, and like organized a big get together for loads of former players. He lives up the road, and you know, Lucas Radebe came from South Africa, and he basically said, no, I don't want to do it. And this is, you know, all he has to do is turn up and eat free lunch and wave at the fans, and so God knows he wants to talk to a Guardian journo. Like, I don't know,
I find it quite refreshing in a way. He did on a there was I think Leeds did a video, and I can't remember what it was for, but he did pop up maybe applauding the NHS. I can't remember what it was. So it was the first time I'd seen him in like 25 years.
That's because he didn't need to leave his front steps.
Yeah, you're right. But interestingly on Batty, Paul Merson always said, they were talking about the penalty shootout where Mer scored against Argentina and Batty missed. And he was like, it was the best person to miss, because afterwards he just sort of put his boots in a bag and went, all right, lads, see you. And that was it. It's sort of quite refreshing. It's very unlike any other. I mean, it's lucky that not all footballers are like that, but I don't know. There's something I really like about it.
I do have a certain regard for footballers who aren't that interested in football, but just happen to be very good at it and can make a very good living out of it, but otherwise aren't even remotely fussed about who they're playing, where they're playing, whether they win or lose. I have a bit of a respect for people like that.
My homework for this was mainly watching Premiership years 94-95, which was absolutely sensational. But Blackburn start the season really well. Newcastle start really well as well. United are in it. And I'd forgotten how far ahead Blackburn were, Michael, and how if they hadn't won this title, it would have been a pretty big choke.
They just got off to an absolute rip-roaring start, having finished second the year before, where they sort of they finished that season the year before really strongly and ultimately missed out by a few points. But yeah, they started so well, and basically it all started to unravel towards the end of the season. They've been leading for the majority of the season, and I remember my dad talking about it, that it would just be sort of typical Blackburn to bottle it on the last day, but ultimately that wasn't to be.
In April, they were 8 points clear with 6 games to go, and then it went to 4 points clear with 4 to go, and 2 points clear on the final day. So it was almost a spectacular bottle job. And I would imagine if the great Ludo McClusker, who was in goal for West Ham on the final day of the season, ever pitches up at any Blackburn watering hole, he won't have to put his hand in his pocket.
I genuinely remember trying to find a McClusker jersey. But I'm sure that all the Rovers fans have already bought it. So,
what was the rivalry like with Manchester United? Because watching Ferguson this season, he looks pretty relaxed. It's not like we were talking about his rivalry with Wenger recently on the pod, and it was sort of really spiky. It didn't seem that him and Dalglish had that kind of rivalry. But I don't know if I'm right there.
They sort of have a long history together, where, like, going back to the 60s, I think, where Ferguson played for Rangers, and I think actually that Dalglish turned out in a reserve team game in defence one day and actually played against him. And obviously, through the late 80s and early 90s, Dalglish, of course, managed Liverpool as well. But, you know, they were both Scotsmen. They both had, like, great wit, you know, but it wasn't like a Keegan-Fergie thing yet.
And actually, in the United's Blackburn games, in both games, Blackburn felt totally robbed by refereeing decisions, didn't they?
It's a weird one. The season before, Blackburn had, I think, they got 4 points from the two games at United and lost and came second. And then, you know, we were done in both games in this year. But that was also because, you know, of sort of Eric Cantona as well, and he was. It was him and Shearer for basically the best player in the league. And I think if Cantona hadn't had his Crystal Palace moment, you know, the season could have ended very differently.
Would it not also be fair to say, Michael, that in Blackburn's first season back in the Premier League, when they finished fourth, they signed Alan Shearer, but he missed the second half of the season with a cruciate injury. But for that, they might have won the league that season. So, you know, swings and roundabouts, I suppose you could say.
Both teams, both United and Blackburn, both had injuries, including in the 94-95 season. We mentioned Batty. Batty only played 6 games. And before that, he was sort of starting centre mid with Tim Sherwood. And Mark Atkins, who most people have either forgotten or have never heard of, 34 times and finished, I think, third top scorer behind the SAS. And, it, you know, things went in favour of one team and against the other. And I think the Cantona thing is fairly, I think it would be the same if Blackburn lost Shearer. It wouldn't have turned out the same. But I think there are other sort of incidental things that happen throughout all of those seasons where, who knows? It's impossible to say.
One of the fascinating things about that Cantona incident, and, you know, if there is one person that doesn't know it, he gets sent off. As he's walking off the pitch, he goes two-footed into a Crystal Palace fan who's giving him stick. He was banned from football for 8 months, fined £20,000, sentenced to 14 days in prison. That was later reduced to 120 hours community service on appeal. But before the FA got involved, Manchester United suspended him for the whole season. And I found that extraordinary, just thinking now if, you know, Aguero or Sadio Mane or whoever did something like that. I just can't imagine a club suspending their player without, you know, you just imagine they would just blindly support them.
I suppose the furore at the time was such. I mean, this was a huge, huge story, as I suppose it still would be if it happened today. But he kind of set a precedent. But it does seem odd that they move before the FA. Why wouldn't you wait? I don't know what the thinking was behind that.
Was there more honour in football in 1995? I don't know.
God, I don't know. It's a big shout.
It is worth pointing out that in 1995, Dennis Wise was convicted of criminal damage and assault relating to a fight with a taxi driver and given a three-month prison sentence. The conviction and sentence was overturned on appeal. George Graham was sacked after nearly 9 months in charge of Arsenal after he took an illegal payment from a Norwegian agent in relation to the signing of Pål Lidesen and John Jensen, which one of my dad's friends who didn't understand football was asked, why is George Graham in so much trouble for accepting buns, like cream buns? I don't know why.
There was also the riot at Lansdowne Road when England fans very kindly began the redevelopment process of what is now the Aviva Stadium.
All right, let's get to the final day then, because sometimes you feel football is scripted, and the idea of Kenny Dalglish winning a league title with Blackburn Rovers at Anfield is perfect, Michael, isn't it?
Yeah, I think everyone I've spoken to has agreed that obviously they would have preferred it to be at Ewood, but there's a great like sort of poetry in having Kenny sort of walking through the dressing room. There's footage of him sort of almost going into the home dressing room by mistake because he sort of looks a bundle of nerves. He's a really superstitious man, and he's so superstitious that he refused to book a celebration party after the match. Obviously, when we won, they ended up they didn't want to go out in Manchester for obvious reasons. So they ended up going to a place called Bistro French in Preston, and they have a Buddy Holly band playing live music, and they just cleared away the tables and had a drink. And some of the players, like some of the regulars, didn't even go to the party. It was just a complete mess. But
did David Batty?
But, yeah. On? Well, I don't know. He probably just went home, didn't he? But yeah, obviously you've got the Liverpool fans cheering against United, but they're also cheering poor Kenny. He's a legend there after, you know, what he did as a player and, you know, the way that he acted through Hillsborough. And, you know, he was only a manager, I think, until 91. So this is all very recent. You know, he's still a young man. So everyone's rooting for Blackburn at Anfield. It was apparently a really strange atmosphere where when Shearer scored the first goal, Tim Flowers talks about how he's obviously stood in front of the cop. And the cops start cheering. The goal's just gone in against Liverpool. It was apparently an incredible atmosphere there.
Can you just describe what it was like in your living room with your dad, listening to those matches and listening to Liverpool take the lead and Man United equalising?
Yeah, well, I mean, the great thing about listening to the radio is that they do it like almost simultaneously. So there's no sort of flicking between channels of missing things. No, that they were checking in with correspondents. It was like a tennis match. I remember that it being in complete disarray. I was obviously really excitable in like full kit, you know, including shin pads. I wasn't even sure at that point if my dad, you know, he only really sort of got into football because I enjoyed it. But in that moment, he was just sort of dancing around like basically a 7-year-old. So it was brilliant.
Will asks, will anyone else ever win the title by knocking it wide and whipping it in? Is that a fair summation of how Blackburn played, do you think?
Yeah. What I don't understand, if you're a fullback, you're a fullback facing Blackburn Rovers, just show Stuart Ripley and Jason Wilcox inside, stand on the outside of them. It doesn't matter. They were both so one-footed. And every time, it's not like they're doing like lollipops and stepovers and roulettes and things. They're like feinting one way and going the other. Once it goes into the box, like Shearer and Sutton at that time were the movement and the way that they sort of played off each other. Once the ball goes into the box, they're always favourite to win it.
It's extraordinary to watch Alan Shearer at his absolute best, you know, and because he did lose a yard of pace after a couple of knee injuries, but sort of this era, you know, up to and including Euro 96, he is just absolutely sensational. And like we said before, he's so sort of deliberate, and there's no subtlety to it, but it doesn't matter.
I mean, remember at this point, Barry mentioned earlier, he has had a cruciate injury, and Jason Wilcox was talking about this because he had one actually right at the end of our title winning season. Now it's a fairly formulaic 6 to 9 months for a recovery, but the long and short of it is that you'll be back. Back then, like, there weren't any guarantees of that. So he's already had one cruciate, and Shearer is still just, I mean, he's getting in behind the centre backs. He's outrunning centre backs, you know. This is not the Shearer of Newcastle where he just sort of volleys it in from 25 yards and headers it all the time.
Do you think Chris Sutton gets the credit he deserves?
I think that he will always be associated with that season for Blackburn because he's part of the SAS, and that is what I think most people think of when they think of Blackburn in that season. So I know that, you know, he did have that fiasco with England B. But there were so many good strikers at the time, but it would have been great if he was given that chance to show what he could do on an international stage as well.
It was a pretty extraordinary season, this. If you think, we've mentioned all the incidents that have happened, and you add to this that incredibly famous press conference with Paul Merson, you know, admitting his problems with alcohol and drugs and gambling and going into rehab, which at the time was extraordinary. You know, those sort of footballers didn't talk openly about those things.
I think Max Merce was left with little choice but to front up because there was stories about him in one of the tabloids. He clearly had a serious problem, drugs, drink and gambling, the trifecta. So he was sort of stood down from duty for the rest of the season after that, I think, or for quite some time anyway, so he could go and get help for these addictions, which, you know, sort of have dogged him ever since. But he's still doing his best and doing all right.
Interestingly, Chris Armstrong was the first Premier League player to receive a ban for doping. He failed a drugs test in February of 95, testing positive for cannabis. Not necessarily performance enhancing.
No. This was a season as well, Max. Bruce Grobbelaar was accused of match fixing. Terry Venables was the subject of financial misconduct charges as well. So yeah, there was a lot going on.
There was a lot of honour, wasn't there?
Well, in terms of saying Your Honour at the courthouse, yeah.
It was the last season the Premier League had 22 teams in it. When I was watching Premiership years, I was wondering what the hell they were all doing there. Four teams were relegated at the end of the season. Only two promoted from Division One. Everton won the FA Cup. I remember being gutted when Daniel Amakachi scored two in the semi-final against Spurs. Everyone was convinced that Klinsmann was going to get Spurs to the FA Cup final. They qualified for the Cup Winners' Cup as a result of that, Everton. And on the Premiership years, there were some great Andy Hinchcliffe in-swinging corners for Duncan Ferguson to just sprint from 10 yards away and just bullet them into the net. Dalglish won Manager of the Season. Shearer got PFA Player of the Year. Robbie Fowler got Young Player of the Year. Klinsmann got Football Writers Footballer of the Year. On the day Blackburn won the league, Divock Origi was nearly a month old. Mrs. Pepe was just 2 weeks away from giving birth to Nicholas Pepe. And producer Jonathan has worked out that Harry Winks was conceived on or around this day 25 years ago.
For Mr. and Mrs. Winks Blackburn fans, do we know?
We don't know.
I was just looking, actually. Five of the teams who finished in the top 10 that season are no longer in the top flight. And in that season's top flight, you had the following teams who are no longer, you know, in the Premiership or Premier League: Blackburn, Leeds, QPR, Nottingham Forest, Sheffield Wednesday, Ipswich, Coventry City and Wimbledon.
Now, you watched Premiership years 94-95, Barry. I found this just absolutely sensational. I don't know if it's just because it's sort of peak football loving for me, where I understood the game enough. I loved this show.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's 90 minutes long and the time flew. But I think it was also helped by the fact that the soundtrack was brilliant, because mid-90s, for me, Clive, was the best time of my life for music. Probably because I stopped listening to music around 1999, so that's where my knowledge of music ends. But there was some cracking tunes in that soundtrack.
They had super slow-mo John Barnes overhead kick against Blackburn to What's the Frequency, Kenneth. Letitia's a montage of his goals to the Crash Test Dummies.
I had a Matt Letizia goals VHS, and it was about 40 minutes long, and they'd obviously only paid for one song, which was on a loop for 40 minutes, and it was EMF, You're Unbelievable. And they timed it, but they'd been clever, because they timed it where they did the da 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 da, and then it would stop, and as it, just before they said you're unbelievable, that's when Letizia would put it in the net. And honestly, I remember watching it for 40 minutes and I would dream of the lyrics. It would be insane. So I'm glad to hear that Sky had a bit more money to do a montage.
But this was also, of course, the season of Matt Letizia's favourite goal of his own, which was the one he scored against Blackburn with his former teammate Tim Flowers in goal, which I suspect is what edged it ahead in the race of many fine goals from Matt Letizia.
Just to add, my favourite bits of music put to action were a relegation montage of players like Mark Steen and Ian Crook wincing to Desiree's You Gotta Be, and John Walk getting sent off for Ipswich while Mr. Bombastic is playing. Barry, I don't know if you saw this, Sam Hammam bringing on an elephant to lead out the teams on the final day at Selhurst Park for Wimbledon v Forest.
Yeah, I mean, you see the grief I got for painting the Football Weekly logo on the flank of an elephant in India. No elephants were harmed in the production of that piece of art, I hasten to add. But Sam Hammam, no one bats an eyelid when he drags one down to Croydon and brings him into the bear pit that is Selhurst Park.
You know those bits on Sunderland Till I Die where Charlie Methven is, you know, asking something ridiculous for a poor member of staff at Sunderland? You do wish there'd been a Wimbledon Till I Die. A couple of messages from Manchester United fans. Jake says, we've had Arsenal winning the title at Old Trafford, Liverpool winning the Champions League, and now Blackburn. As a Manchester United fan, there is only so much pain I can take. Matt says, it's a difficult week for United fans on Football Weekly. I listened to that final day of the season on my headphones on my Walkman radio at the Sunday dinner table, annoying my mum by not eating and then getting very grumpy for the rest of the day when we couldn't beat West Ham.
A friend of mine was asking me yesterday what we were doing for Football Weekly today, and I explained, and he's a Manchester United fan. He was very, very upset. So I think we should probably do something that involves Manchester United winning a game or winning a trophy at some point soon.
Michael, you wanted to mention your granddad.
Oh, yeah. Only just that we were talking about Jack Walker, and just remember that I mentioned that all my family are sort of from that area. And My granddad was actually buying a house off Jack Walker. He owned a bit of property around Ewood Park. And my grandfather is actually the black sheep of the family. He supports Burnley. And when Jack Walker found this out, he tried to put, I think, about $5,000 on the house. Now, I'm not sure how much the house is worth, but I think tensions run deep in that area.
Well, look out for Michael's piece in the paper, and we'll tweet that out as well. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll round up all the latest news on Project Restart and everything else. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. So the latest on Project Restart. There was a call on Monday. There's another one next Monday between the Premier League. No decisions made yet. A few things were established. A majority of teams are now in favour of playing games at home grounds. Police are open to that idea. There are still plenty of concerns around player safety and health, with more chats scheduled to address those. Danny Rose has spoken up for player safety. He was on Instagram Live saying, "I don't give an F about the nation's morale. Football shouldn't even be spoke about until the numbers have dropped massively. People's lives are at risk." He was joined by Raheem Sterling, who said on his YouTube channel, "The moment we do go back, it just needs to be a moment where it's not just for footballing reasons. It's safe for not just us footballers, but the whole medical staff, referees. I feel like once that side of the people's safety and the players' safety is secured and their well-being is looked after, then that's the right time to go back in. Until then, I'm, how can I say, not scared, but reserved and thinking what the worst outcome could be. I've had friends whose grandmas passed away. I've had family members as well that have passed away. You've got to be wise and take care of yourself and those around you." Troy Townsend of Kick It Out said, "I can't visualise watching my son play during this uncertainty." It's clear, Baz, the mood among the footballing community is pretty mixed at the moment.
It seems to be, yeah. I mean, I've nailed my colours to the mast. I think it's madness. But if the Premier League are determined to start playing again, they're running out of time because they don't have another meeting scheduled till next Monday. And then they have another week after that. It's sort of the deadline for when they have to announce what they're going to do, announce their plan and how they're going to get the league finished. And as yet, they don't have one. And then the time frame after that is they need to get it finished by August the 2nd. So even without any setbacks or bumps in the road, they're already under extreme time pressure to get it fixed by playing behind closed doors. And if they can't get it finished playing behind closed doors, then they have to come up with a way of settling the league. Now, in all the sort of available options, Liverpool win, Chelsea, Leicester and Man United qualify for the Champions League behind them. But there are differences if they go with the table as it stands, points per game, weighted points per game, roll back to game week 27 or roll back to game week 19. They're the available options. Various teams, different teams get relegated depending on which option they would go for. So they need to get a move on. I think today being Wednesday when we're recording, the players were finally sort of brought into the equation, and there was senior players from each club were presented with sort of safety. I think it was an attempt to tell them, look, it's you're not going to be at a huge amount of risk or anything. But it is nice to see that the players are finally actually being consulted.
Mm. Jason Burt in the Telegraph, there was a tweet sent by Telegraph Football saying, "Exclusive report on the Premier League plans to convince captains and managers that it's safe to resume includes telling players to, quote, turn your face away when tackled." It's actually, it's a brilliant headline. It's obviously completely ludicrous. It actually was players being advised to turn their face away when getting up from a challenge, which is slightly different, but it still, Michael, just shows how, I mean, you cannot social distance while you're playing a game of football, right? That is, apart from, I once played a charity game with Teddy Sheringham and he was in 20 yards of space every time he got the ball, but it is ludicrous, isn't it?
I'd quite like to see a scenario where players have to turn their face away from the ball when heading the ball. That'd be good. Maybe they could consult Javier Hernandez over that one. But on a serious note, if players are heading the ball and that's been handled by a throw-in, 10 seconds previously, there's all kinds of scenarios that you can sort of dream up. I just can't see until everybody's on board and it's unanimous that we can go ahead. But I enjoyed today the Norwich sporting director, Stuart Webber. Norwich, of course, 6 points adrift at the bottom of the Premier League, saying that promotion to the Premier League should be scrapped if Championship clubs fail to complete their season.
Yeah, I know. It's so ludicrous when,
in the interest of fairness. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Dan Rowan at the BBC saying tackling will be banned, pitches disinfected and players restricted to groups of five when the Premier League starts a first phase of team training. Corner flags, balls, cones, goalposts, even playing surfaces will be disinfected after each session. League bosses hope training can begin on Monday and restricted to 75 minutes. One thing that's on my mind, and probably on yours as well, Michael, because you play amateur football as well to a significantly higher level than I do, is when that might come back. And there was a piece today, actually, about how many volunteers will be needed given the state of amateur pitches.
Well, I'm on the bench normally, so it doesn't matter much. But yeah, I mean, I can't see how we are going to... Normally, we, you know, I'd say most teams start some sort of pre-season in August. And that's I can't see that happening. You know, just in line with what the government are saying about all the phased returns, I just can't see a normal season kicking off. I just can't see it happening.
Are you practicing playing at all? I bought a football. I couldn't do 100 kick-ups today. Like, my touch is gone.
I actually haven't kicked a ball in earnest in about 2-3 months. So, since whenever this thing started, so it feels like ages. But I haven't been doing anything. I'm absolutely desperate to get out there. You know, we're allowed to play sport with our. I might enlist my girlfriend to the park. Get a ball in ASAP.
You know those chairs in TalkSport towers that like little legs,
yeah.
Like Mork and Mindy's Mork space pod. Well, the last time I kicked a football, I put one into one of those chairs from about 15 yards with my right foot, which is my bad foot. So I have vowed to never kick a football again. I want that to be the last time I kick a football because it was so good and so surprising.
Here's a question from Richard. He says, what entirely meaningless thing will in your mind confirm football is properly back? For me, it is the first sarcastic cheer for an away team passing it out of play. It's going to be so long until that happens, isn't it?
I'm quite looking forward to just the first time seeing a fan sort of make the big belly gesture and then put the pointing big belly gesture. Yeah, or you.
Oh, I quite like when they put both hands, you know, as far apart, sort of wingspan, and they do that one and then they point and go, you, me, outside. Because you would as a fan go, well, I've paid for a ticket. But actually what I could do is I could leave this thing I want to be at, go outside and have my head kicked in. It's win-win, isn't it?
Maybe that's what Benjani was doing when he was celebrating.
Well, look, that'll do for today's pod. Michael, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks a lot.
Barry, thank you as always.
Yeah, you're very welcome as always.
Monday's podcast will be a look back at a game from just 2 weeks after Blackburn secured the title, the 1995 Champions League final between Ajax and Milan. Two absolutely classic lineups: Van der Sar, Blind, Rijkaard, the De Boer brothers, Overmars, David, Seedorf, Lippmann, and against Maldini, Baresi, Desai, Boban, Costa, Curta, Panucci, and Albertini, etc., etc. We'll be doing that with Musa Okwonga and Ryan Hun from the Stadio podcast. But finishing today, Barry Glendening reads Heroes by David Bowie.
David Bowie, by the way, who was born less than 3 minutes' walk away from where I am sitting next street from mine. Anyway, I will be king. And you will be queen. Though nothing will drive them away, we can beat them just for one day. We can be heroes just for one day. And you can be mean, and I'll drink all the time. 'Cause we're lovers, and that is a fact. Yes, we're lovers, and that is that. Though nothing will keep us together, we could steal time just for one day. We can be heroes forever and ever. What do you say? I wish you could swim, like dolphins can swim. Though nothing will keep us together, we can beat them forever and ever. Oh, we can be heroes just for one day.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.